Penguin Random House Audio presents Give People Money, How a Universal Basic Income Would End Poverty, Revolutionize Work, and Remake the World. This is the author, Annie Lowry. Introduction: Wages for Breathing. One oppressively hot and muggy day in July, I stood at a military installation at the top of a mountain called Dorasan, overlooking the demilitarized zone between South Korea and North Korea. The central building was painted in camouflage and emblazoned with the hopeful phrase, "End of separation, beginning of unification." On one side was a large open observation deck with a number of telescopes aimed toward the Kaesong Industrial Area, a special pocket between the two countries where, up until recently, communist workers from the north would come and toil for capitalist companies from the south, earning $90 million in wages a year. A small gift shop sold soju liquor made by northern workers and chocolate-covered soybeans grown in the demilitarized zone itself. Don't like them? Mail them back for a refund, the package said. On the other side was a theater whose seats faced not a movie screen, but windows looking out toward North Korea. In front, there was a labeled diorama. Here's a flag. Here's a factory. Here's a Juche-inspiring statue of Kim Il-sung. See it there? Can you make out his face, his hands? Chinese tourists pointed between the diorama and the landscape, viewed through the summer haze. Across the 4-kilometer-wide demilitarized zone, the North Koreans were blasting propaganda music so loudly that I could hear not just the tunes, but the words. I asked my tour guide, Soojin, what the song said. The usual, she responded. Stuff about how South Koreans are the tools of the Americans and the North Koreans will come to liberate us from our capitalist slavery. Looking at the denuded landscape before us, this bit of pomposity seemed impossibly sad, as did the incomplete tunnel from north to south, scratched out beneath us, as did the little Potemkin village the North Koreans had set up in sight of the observation deck. It was supposedly home to 200 families, who Pyongyang insisted were working a collective farm, using a child care center, schools, a hospital. Yet Seoul had determined that nobody had ever lived there, and the buildings were empty shells. Comrades would come turn the lights on and off to give the impression of activity. The North Koreans called it Peace Village. Soojin called it Propaganda Village. A few members of the group I was traveling with, including myself, teared up at the stark difference between what was in front of us and what was behind. There is perhaps no place on earth that better represents the profound life and death power of our choices when it comes to government policy. Less than a lifetime ago, the two countries were one, their people a polity, their economies a single fabric. But the Cold War's ideological and political rivalry between capitalism and communism had ripped them apart, dividing families and scarring both nations. Soojin talked openly about the separation of North Korea from the South as our national tragedy. The Republic of Korea, the South, rocketed from third world to first world status, becoming one of only a handful of countries to do so in the post-war era. In 1960, about 15 years after the division of the peninsula, its people were about as wealthy as those in the Ivory Coast and Sierra Leone. In 2016, they were closer income-wise to those in Japan, its former colonial occupier, and a brutal one. Citigroup now expects South Korea to be among the most prosperous countries on Earth by 2040, richer even than the United States by some measures. Yet the Democratic People's Republic of Korea, the North, has faltered and failed, particularly since the 1990s. It is a famine-scarred pariah state, dominated by governmental graft and military buildup. Rare is it for a country to suffer such a miserable growth pattern without also suffering from the curse of natural disasters or the horrors of war. As of a few years ago, an estimated 40% of the population was living in extreme poverty, more than double the share of people in Sudan. Were war to befall the country, that proportion would inevitably rise. Even from the remove of the observation deck, enveloped in steam, hemmed in by barbed wire, patrolled by passive young men with assault rifles, the difference was obvious. You could see it. I could see it. The South Korean side of the border was lush with forest and riven with well-built highways. Everywhere there were power lines, trains, docks, high-rise buildings. An hour south sat Seoul, as cosmopolitan and culturally rich a city as Paris, with far better infrastructure than New York or Los Angeles. But the North Korean side of the border was stripped of trees. People had perhaps cut them down for firewood and basic building supplies, Soojin told me. The roads were empty and plain, the buildings low and small. So were the people. North Koreans are now measurably shorter than their South Korean relatives, in part due to the stunting effects of malnutrition. South Korea and North Korea demonstrated, so powerfully demonstrated, that what we often think of as economic circumstance is largely a product of policy. The way things are is really the way we choose for them to be. There's always a counterfactual. Perhaps that counterfactual is not as stark as it is at the demilitarized zone, but it is always there. Imagine that a check showed up in your mailbox or your bank account every month. The money would be enough to live on, but just barely. It might cover a room in a shared apartment, food and bus fare. It would save you from destitution if you had just gotten out of prison, needed to leave an abusive partner, or could not find work. But it would not be enough to live particularly well on. Let's say that you could do anything you wanted with the money. It would come with no strings attached. You could use it to pay your bills. You could use it to go to college or save it up for a down payment on a house. You could spend it on cigarettes and booze or finance a life spent playing Candy Crush in your mom's basement and noodling around on the internet. Or you could use it to quit your job and make art, devote yourself to charitable works, or care for a sick child. Let's also say that you did not have to do anything to get the money. It would just show up every month, month after month, for as long as you lived. You would not have to be a specific age, have a child, own a home, or maintain a clean criminal record to get it. You just would, as would every other person in your community. This simple, radical, and elegant proposal is called a universal basic income, or UBI. It is universal in the sense that every resident of a given community or country receives it. It is basic in that it's just enough to live on and not more. And it is income. The idea is a very old one, with its roots in Tudor England and the writings of Thomas Paine, a curious piece of intellectual flotsam that has washed ashore again and again over the last half millennium, often coming in with the tides of economic revolution. In the past few years, with the middle class getting squeezed, trust in government eroding, technological change hastening, the economy getting uberized, and a growing body of research on the power of cash as an anti-poverty measure being produced, it has vaulted to a surprising prominence, even pitching from airy hypothetical to near reality in some places. Mark Zuckerberg, Hillary Clinton, the Black Lives Matter movement, Bill Gates, Elon Musk. These are just a few of the policy proposals' flirts, converts, and supporters. UBI pilots are starting or ongoing in Germany, the Netherlands, Finland, Canada, and Kenya, with India contemplating one as well. Some politicians are trying to get it adopted in California, and it has already been the subject of a Swiss referendum, where its reception exceeded activists' expectations, despite its defeat. Why undertake such a drastic policy change, one that would fundamentally alter the social contract, the safety net, and the nature of work? UBI's strange bedfellows put forward a dizzying kaleidoscope of arguments, drawing on everything from feminist theory to environmental policy to political philosophy to studies of work incentives to sociological work on racism. Perhaps the most prominent argument for UBI has to do with technological unemployment, the prospect that robots will soon take all of our jobs. Economists at Oxford University estimate that about half of American jobs, including millions and millions of white-collar ones, are susceptible to imminent elimination due to technological.
Sample complete. Ready to continue?